You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 22nd of May 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Emma Nelson. Coming up on today's show, we ask who would want a Eurobond? Also today, put it away please, there are protests at a portrait of Jacob Zuma that is just too intimate for some. Plus, another Scandinavian tail fin vanishes from the skies. This time it's Skyways, which is filing for bankruptcy. And form an orderly queue, please. Everest gets overcrowded. All that, plus a chat about the Olympics with our very own Adrian Craddock. That's all coming up on Midori House, here on Monocle 24. All that to look forward to then. But before all that, let's get the latest news from Nick Kelly.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Nick Kelly. An unmanned Falcon 9 rocket lifted off from Cape Canaveral today for a mission designed to be the first commercial flight to the International Space Station. Less than 10 minutes later, the rocket, owned by privately held Space Exploration Technologies, or SpaceX, delivered its cargo, a Dragon capsule with 500 kilos of supplies for the station crew, into orbit. NASA is counting on companies like SpaceX to take over the task of flying cargo and eventually astronauts to the International Space Station. Here's NASA Administrator Charles Bolden.
A private company has launched a spacecraft to the International Space Station that will attempt to dock there for the first time. And while there's a lot of work ahead to successfully complete this mission, we're certainly off to a good start, and I hope you would all agree on that.
The OECD has said the United States and Japan are leading a fragile developed world recovery that could be blown off course if Europe fails to contain the damage from its problem debtor states. It urged Eurozone leaders to embrace all options for tackling the crisis, potentially including common bonds to go with the common currency. In its twice-yearly economic outlook, the Paris-based Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development forecast that global growth would ease to 3.4% this year from 3.6% in 2011, before accelerating to 4.2% in 2013, in line with its last estimates from late November. The jailed Bahraini activist Abdul Hadi al-Khawaja, on hunger strike for more than 3 months, was brought to court in a wheelchair today when the retrial resumed of 13 men imprisoned over protests that rocked the island last year. A military court convicted the men of using violence in protests led by majority Shiite Muslims in an effort to topple the Sunni monarchy. Earlier today, Monocle spoke to Maryam al-Khawaja, the daughter of Abdul Hadi, and the acting president of the Bahrain Centre for Human Rights.
My father took the last thing that he had control over, which was his own body, to use it as a form of protest against the ongoing violations that the government is committing.
Yemen's National Day parade in the capital Sana'a today was a day of mourning for the country's soldiers after a bloody suicide attack yesterday killed 90 of their comrades and wounded more than 200 during rehearsals. But the chief of staff, Brigadier Ahmed Ali El Ashwal, said he would not let the attackers intimidate him or Yemen's armed forces, and the parade went ahead as planned. An al-Qaeda affiliate threatened more attacks if a US-backed campaign against militants in the frontline state didn't stop. A South African court has found black farmhand Chris Malangu guilty of murdering Eugène Terre-Blanche, a white supremacist prominent during the dying years of apartheid, in a wage dispute. A second man, who was a minor at the time of the April 2010 murder, was found guilty of housebreaking in Ventersdorp, a farming community about 125 kilometres west of Johannesburg, where Terre-Blanche owned a farm. Two men vandalised a portrait of the South African president Jacob Zuma with his genitals exposed today, intensifying a heated debate about the picture that's enraged the ruling African National Congress. Television footage showed a white middle-aged man in a suit walking up to the portrait at a Johannesburg gallery and painting a red cross on the president's face and private parts. A TV reporter witnessed what happened.
And then suddenly there was this gentleman on the right-hand side of me with like a sort of light grey jacket sidling along. And I thought, okay, well, he's just, you know, inching in to get a better view. Suddenly I see him whip out a can of paint, red paint, and a paintbrush, and he draws an X over the genital area of the picture.
And one of the London Olympics 2012 torchbearers has already sold her torch on the auction website eBay. Sarah Milner-Simmons has reportedly sold hers for nearly $242,000 for charity. Sarah says the money will be used for a community allotment. However, others aren't so happy about the eBay auction.
It's amazing for me as growing up in this part of the world in Cornwall for the Olympic torch to set off here around the nation. It's a fantastic moment for the UK, for London 2012, and so I'm very excited.
And I just looked on eBay. There's a couple of torches going for £100,000, including an XXL uniform. Those are the top stories on Monocle 24.
Nick, thank you very much indeed. We'll be getting the latest on that Jacob Zuma portrait story in the next half hour or so, so do stay with us. It's just creeping up to 6 minutes past the hour, and you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
Добро пожаловать, Monocle 24.
Du lytter til Monocle 24.
Están escuchando Monocle 24.
Monocle 24, no gigantes.
Du lyssnar på Monocle 24.
Você está escutando a Monocle 24.
Sie hören Monocle 24.
Acute Monocle 24.
Kuuntelet Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
Well, only last week it was more a question of when rather than if Greece left the euro. Now it's beginning to sink in that if the Grexit were to happen, it could set a dangerous precedent for other struggling economies to follow and thus reduce confidence in the entire zone. So the idea of the Eurobond has surfaced once again. It was dismissed last autumn as unworkable, with the Germans in particular worried they'd end up saddled with debt. So why, 6 months on, is it once more a possibility? Well, to discuss this, we're joined now by Dr. Richard Wellings of the Institute of Economic Affairs. A very warm welcome to Midori House, Richard. The return of the subject, is it simply an effort to put everything on the table again just to make sure that everything's covered so that Greece can stay in the euro?
That's right. I mean, there's immense commitment in amongst the EU elites to the euro project, and they don't want to see anything drag it apart. So really, they're looking around for anything that will solve the situation.
The Germans last time said they didn't want it, and one German minister this time around has said it is the wrong prescription at the wrong time. Are they right?
Yes, I mean, this idea would be really bad for German taxpayers, and it would drag some of the stronger Eurozone countries potentially into the middle of the crisis. So let's not forget that German debt levels are already quite high, and if they had to take on the debts of some of these struggling countries like Italy, it could really get into the sort of dangerous territory.
I mean, you say there that there's a potential that it could act to destabilise the German economy. Would you say it was remotely relevant that Frau Merkel is facing elections as well?
Well, of course, and the German political elite is really, to some extent, been ignoring huge disquiet in Germany about the various hidden subsidies to the southern European countries, and I think really the Eurobonds could be the straw that broke the camel's back.
Having said that, would the Eurobond give the opportunity for Greece to benefit from the better credit ratings of other Eurozone countries? So in actual fact, it would give them a chance to perhaps begin to recover?
Well, it would, but there's also a danger there, and that's that it would actually undermine the incentives for Greek politicians and politicians in Spain and Portugal as well to actually undertake these very difficult reforms. If they knew that things are going to get easier in terms of borrowing money, then it does kind of create a moral hazard situation. So they think, oh, Germany's going to back us up now.
So basically, if Greece were to get bailed out, it would effectively undermine everybody's role in the euro.
That's the problem, and eventually it would be a mechanism to create a fiscal union. So you'd see these big transfers from Germany and other richer countries to the poorer countries in the south. And this is really unhealthy, so it weakens the stronger countries. And it also weakens the weaker countries because they become more and more dependent on these subsidies from elsewhere.
Now, you say that, but possibly unsurprisingly, Mario Monti and the Spanish Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy have shown their backing for Eurobonds. I mean, Monti, one would say, perhaps not, because he generally is in agreement with Frau Merkel.
Well, it's clearly self-interest on their parts, because they would actually see a fall in their borrowing costs, whereas Germans and people in Holland, Austria and Finland would see a rise in their borrowing costs if the debts were to be merged. So it's clearly pure self-interest.
How about the argument from Germany that if there were to be deeper fiscal integration with the countries more united politically, a Eurobond could possibly work in that respect?
I don't think that's right, and the reason is, I mean, part of the problem with the euro is a monetary problem. So you have this one-size-fits-all monetary policy across this huge geographical area. So we saw huge inflation in countries like Spain and Ireland, which inevitably would lead to a severe boom-bust cycle, and fiscal union isn't going to actually solve that problem.
We're talking about fiscal union, and I don't know if I'm correct in making this observation, but the French, who've obviously brought this idea back, almost give the impression that Eurobonds and the renegotiation of the fiscal pact might practically go hand in hand. What would you say to that?
Well, we have seen that with what the OECD's been saying in support of Francois Hollande, saying that some of these Eurobonds could be used to fund growth creation measures such as new infrastructure and so on. But the problem is actually governments are really bad at these growth-creating measures, and they tend to pick hugely inefficient infrastructure projects that actually end up destroying growth and require huge taxpayer subsidies. So this really is the wrong route for Europe.
So what other mechanisms would you say were available?
Well, the only viable option is for some of these countries to undertake very radical reforms, particularly to their labour markets, which are extremely rigid. So in Spain, we have 25% unemployment overall and 50% youth unemployment. So they need desperately to reform their labour markets.
Let's move on to the fact that it was, you know, I think it's France who mooted the idea of the Eurobonds again. And yet a couple of days ago, Frau Merkel was saying, you know, no disagreements among anybody. Are we perhaps pushing ahead a bit too far here, but maybe seeing the beginning of a falling out between France and Germany?
Well, I think there are tensions there, obviously, but I think on both sides, they're both heavily committed to the European project and increased centralisation over the long term. So there are big incentives for them to find some sort of agreement. Also, we'll expect a larger role for the European Central Bank, which we haven't mentioned. And that's where the real power is to bail out these countries such as Spain and Italy.
So what would be the ECB's ECB's role in this?
Well, what they've been doing over the past few months is they've been lending vast sums to the banks in countries like Spain and Italy, and these banks have then used it to buy government bonds. So it's actually helped keep borrowing costs down in both Spain and Italy and the other struggling countries. So it's a hidden bailout, which of course in the long run it creates inflation dangers, particularly for Germans, who ineffectively, when the ECB prints money, German taxpayers are losing out.
And finally, the fact that the Eurobond is back on the table, is that a sign that discussions are now moving perhaps towards a more pro-growth direction, given the fact that governments which have pushed forward for austerity have suffered badly in recent elections?
Well, I don't think they've really got much room for manoeuvre. Remember, I mean, austerity actually can be good for growth because it actually reduces government spending and allows the private productive sector to have more resources. And actually, it's private investment that drives growth, not government spending in the long term. So really, I think it's a bit of a false debate between austerity and growth. Austerity can actually be a good thing to promote growth.
Thank you very much indeed. That was Dr. Richard Wellings from the Institute of Economic Affairs. You're listening to Midori House. The time is 13 minutes past the hour.
In Tasmania, talented craftspeople are making use of the island's natural materials to design and build furniture and ceramics. Monocle Video journalist Gabriel Lee toured the island to meet the designer makers putting Tasmania's personality on the map.
It seemed to me that if I was going to make pots at this time and in this culture, I needed to say something about being here and now. And the way to do that was through the materials.
You can watch this and many more Monocle films from affairs to business, culture to design in the programs menu on monocle.com.
The June issue of Monocle is a round-the-world ticket that takes in the best boats and planes and trains in our annual transport survey. We also reach for the skies as we climb to the top of Tokyo's new Skytree Tower, stay ahead as we meet an Ethiopian Olympic icon, and visit Kolkata as the city tries to step up a gear. And there's lots more.
In the affairs section, we head to Bogota and Cartagena to see how Colombia is set to become a South American superpower. We meet Tibet's new leader, and we also visit the Emirate you've probably never heard of.
In the business section this month, we start off by firing the starting pistol in the London Olympics with an in-depth look at the suppliers behind the games, from Italian exercise equipment to French flag-making expertise. We'll also be learning how Cathay Pacific's new high-flying CEO manages, and we'll be staying in the region when we head to the Indonesian city of Yogyakarta, which provides a much cosier version of the congested capital.
There's also our 36-page Thailand National Survey that puts a spotlight on the country's top tech firms, horticultural hothouses, and some cool brewers too. The June issue of Monocle is on newsstands now or available via subscription at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back to Midori House. In a moment, we'll be talking about a scandal involving a painting involving a president and his parts. But before that, some music. This is Coffee and TV by Blur. Coffee and TV there by Blur. You're listening to Midori House. Welcome back. You are not raising a discussion, you are insulting people. That's just one of the comments about a portrait of the South African president, Jacob Zuma. The portrait, which has gone on show in a Johannesburg gallery, shows the president posing as Lenin. Edgy enough, one might argue, but add to that the fact that he's painted with his genitals hanging out and you have somewhat of a scandal. And as we've just heard in the news, in the last hour or so, it appears someone's covered up Mr. Zuma's modesty for him. Well, to tell us all, Monocle's Alex Duval-Smith is on the line now from Cape Town. Very well and welcome, Alex. Before we get the latest on this picture, can you describe it to us?
Yes, thanks, Emma. Well, it's basically a life-size portrait, about 1.85 meters, so really life-size. The picture of Zuma, I would say looking less like Lenin than just looking like Zuma. It's looking like Lenin because he's sort of turning his head back in a Lenin-like pose, but he's looking very much like Zuma at work. He's wearing a suit and tie and a coat on top, and the only thing that doesn't make him look quite so much like he's going about his everyday business is that his penis is hanging out.
Charming. The artist Brett Murray is well known in South Africa for his work criticising the white minority apartheid government that ended in 1994. But has he given any indication as to what's behind this depiction of Zuma?
He hasn't, and actually that makes it all the more intriguing. Brett Murray hasn't been heard of, or hasn't spoken since the controversy began. That was on Sunday. And in fact, it probably would have come and gone, this controversy, had it not been for the African National Congress deciding to denounce the portrait as an insult on the president, and actually to launch legal action to have it banned and withdrawn from show. That legal action led today to a judge announcing that there'd be a verdict on Thursday, which will be announced live on television. Of such importance is this matter. So we'll get back to that. But essentially, no, Brett Murray has been quiet on the subject. But if I can just kind of, in a nutshell, sum up what the sight of President Zuma plus genitals sort of evokes in the South African mind, then it's words like rape, polygamy, essentially a president who by many is seen to be having a good time but not really doing very much for the country. And then this sort of ongoing South African search with itself about what the boundaries should be, given that this country has this amazing constitution which only guaranteed freedom of speech in 1994. So, you know, it's kind of still pushing the boundaries and trying what's acceptable and what isn't. But an awful lot of issues are raised by this picture.
We'll go back to these issues in a moment, but I think it is only fair that you were saying that there's going to be a verdict announced in a couple of days live on television as to whether this painting should continue to be on show. But as we mentioned a moment ago, it appears that someone has already done the job of covering up Mr. Zuma already. Tell us what's happened in the last couple of hours.
The Goodman Gallery in Johannesburg had a visit from one black man, one white man, armed with red paint and black paint, and they painted red crosses over the picture, which incidentally is called The Spear, and threw black paint on his genitals. So it's still, oh, it's still hanging there. And the other thing I wanted to mention is that this is in one of the most prestigious art galleries in South Africa, but it's already a private painting. It's already been bought by someone, and we're all dying to know who that is and what they're now going to do with this painting, which has presumably increased in value quite considerably.
How did the people get in to actually deface the picture? Because there have been widespread protests outside the gallery, and security's stepped up, so this isn't really very surprising that there's going to be an attack.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't in Johannesburg, and I don't know is the short answer. But a black man and a white man walking into a gallery could be people wanting to look at art. I don't know how they arranged it. I don't think there's any suggestion that the Goodman Gallery put on a stunt or anything. Definitely this happened, but not quite sure how they got away with it.
Let's go back to these issues surrounding the portrait, because it is highly, highly inflammatory. I mean, the ANC, like you say, has tried to get it banned, saying it's an attempt to return to apartheid. Is it as deeply felt as that?
Well, I mean, the thinking behind that statement is the following. White South Africans have an obsession with black sexuality and believe that black men are very horny. That is the sort of stereotypical white view of black South Africans. That's why the ANC can say this portrait is racist. Now, a lot of people will say that's really, really far-fetched, but there have been a lot of examples of that sort of image that's held by white South Africans of black Africans as holding true. And certainly President Thabo Mbeki's position on HIV, some analysts have said, which you'll remember he denied that HIV leads to AIDS, could be explained by the fact that he didn't want Africans to be tarred with this brush of being sex obsessed. So that's the racism claim.
The fact that Jacob Zuma has four wives and 21 children, and so one could argue he has a reputation. Nonetheless, though, how important in South Africa is a public figure's privacy?
Well, I mean, I think you're getting to the nub of the matter now, not so much on the privacy issue, but on the polygamy issue. At the end of this year, there's going to be an ANC conference at which Jacob Zuma is expected to run to renew his mandate to be president of the party, and because of the ANC's crushing majority in South Africa, that means he'll be president for another term. One of the elements which is raised in criticism of Zuma quite regularly is his fairly lavish lifestyle, but especially the fact that he has four wives that have to be taken care of at the taxpayer's expense. Each has an assistant, each has a house, and they get public funds to help them to deal with that lifestyle of being first ladies. So the polygamy issue is one that, you know, you can't really divorce that. You can't say Jacob Zuma's got his right to privacy when he's got four wives that are costing the taxpayer money.
Is this kind of art becoming increasingly common in South Africa? In terms of how scandalous or trying to be provocative?
Well, I think there's a sort of perhaps a growing culture of people, of artists, just wanting to go see how far they can go. There's a quite now famous lesbian photographer, Zanele Moholi, who opened an exhibition about a year ago in Johannesburg, at which the culture minister was due to cut the ribbon and promptly refused when she saw lesbians in naked embrace in the photograph. And then there's a very popular and often written about cartoonist Zapiro, who draws very provocative cartoons. But there's a bit of a culture of it. I'm not sure if it's increasing. I think it's very interesting, though, that South Africa does find the need to see how, you know, what is acceptable, having come from a very conservative history and culture, and just sort of artists pushing the boundaries left and right to see just what's acceptable.
And finally, Alex, you mentioned that there's going to be a ruling in the next couple of days on it. What is the general expectation of what's going to happen?
I'd be very surprised if the South African High Court, which is a defender, after all, of the freedom of speech and the Constitution, would go anywhere near banning a work like this, because that would be too reminiscent of the morality code of apartheid South Africa. It would send off a very negative message indeed about the future route that South African legislature was taking.
Alix de Waal Smith on the line from Cape Town. Thank you very much indeed for joining us here on Midori House.
Det här är Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dobro pozhalovat, Monocle 24.
Essa é Monocle 24.
Detta är Monocle 24.
Están escuchando Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Monocle 24
this. This is Monocle 24.
Afton into Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
It's 1:30 the hour and you're listening to Midori House. In the next half hour, we'll chat with Monocle's Adrian Craddock about his recent magazine piece on the companies behind the 2012 Olympics. And the Swedish airline Skyways has just filed for bankruptcy. We'll be getting the latest on that. Before that, let's hear from Nick Kelly for the latest news headlines.
Thanks, Emma. An unmanned Falcon 9 rocket lifted off from Cape Canaveral today for a mission designed to be the first commercial flight to the International Space Station. The OECD has said the United States and Japan are leading a fragile developed world recovery that could be blown off course if Europe fails to contain the damage from its problem debt estates. The jailed Bahraini activist Abdul Hadi al-Khawaja on hunger strike for more than 3 months was brought to court in a wheelchair today when the retrial resumed of 13 men imprisoned over protests that rocked the island last year. The leader of Lebanon's Shiite Hezbollah group called for calm today after people blocked roads and burned tyres in southern Beirut in protest against the kidnapping of 13 Lebanese Shiites by rebels in neighbouring Syria. Yemen's National Day parade in the capital Sana'a was a day of mourning today for the country's soldiers after a bloody suicide attack yesterday killed 90 of their comrades and wounded more than 200 during rehearsals. The UN nuclear watchdog chief has said he expected to sign a deal with Iran soon to ease investigation into suspected work on atom bombs, potentially brightening prospects for big power talks with Tehran to stop a drift towards conflict. A South African court has found black farmhand Chris Malangu guilty of murdering Eugene Terblanche, a white supremacist prominent during the dying years of apartheid, in a wage dispute. Two men vandalised a portrait of South African President Jacob Zuma with his genitals exposed today, intensifying a heated debate about the picture that has enraged the ruling African National Congress. And one of the London Olympics 2012 torchbearers has already sold her torch on the auction website eBay. Sarah Milner-Simmons has reportedly sold hers for nearly $242,000 for charity. Those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
Nick, thank you very much indeed. And Nick will be back at the top of the hour for a full roundup of today's world news headlines. We'll stay with the Olympics now. And every day this week on Midori House, we've been chatting with the writers and editors behind the best stories in Monocle magazines. All of them rather good, though, I must confess. The latest edition of which is out now on newsstands around the world. Today, we're joined by Monocle 24's own Adrian Craddock, who's written a piece about the companies which have provided the nuts and bolts to make the upcoming 2012 Olympics in London happen. A very warm welcome to the studio, Adrian. So you're looking at the little businesses behind the Olympics. That was your brief.
Exactly. Locog made a very big deal out of saying that the £11 billion budget, most of it will go to English companies and will reinvigorate the economy. So part of my article was trying to find out whether they achieved that.
And did they? $1 million question or the $11 billion question?
Well, I think they did. They did a pretty good job. I mean, the fireworks, the mascot costumes, everything from, you know, the seating. A lot of it was done by UK companies. But still, you know, there were still a few gaps where they had to call in a bit of foreign help.
When you talk about, you know, such a large proportion of the companies were from the UK, I mean, how hard and how long did they actually look for the right supplier?
Well, I mean, the contracts have been, they've been asking for contracts since 2009. That's when they advertised for companies to come through. And I think, as you mentioned there, they claim that 98% of the contracts were awarded to UK firms. It's very kind of difficult to kind of make heads and tails of this, though, because my experience researching this article, there's so much secrecy around this whole process and around kind of the final results of what's going to come from these contracts. I mean, especially just little things like I tried to do a little thing on where are the flowers coming from for the victory ceremonies, just those little bouquets that you see. And I was calling, trying to find out, you know, who was the company that had won this contract. And it was like I was in a James Bond novel or something like that. They just wouldn't tell me, you know, and it's...
What kind of answers were you getting? Was it a flat no or we can't tell you?
Well, it's just kind of, you know, very ambiguous, very kind of like, well, there will be later announcements to be had. I mean, we're not really comfortable kind of disclosing this yet.
That's very odd, because the British are always really good at giving the game away without wanting to.
I guess
so. Just with a look.
But they did pretty well. So just things like, you know, the podiums and the flowers, a lot of secrecy, and especially with the fireworks. I remember trying to research kind of what the detail, the nuts and bolts of the contract were for the fireworks, and just absolutely nothing, getting a stonewall. I guess that's to be expected, though.
I mean, whoever won it had the worst, arguably the worst job of all, because after the Beijing Olympics, basically got every firework in the world and set fire to it at the same time. London is going to have a pretty hard job. Who ended up getting it and why did they get it? Or were you just not told?
No, I was told, actually. The fireworks are an interesting one because it comes from a relatively small company. They're called Kim Bolton. And they started in the 1960s. They were started by Reverend Ron Lancaster, who was the chaplain of a school in Cambridgeshire. And he kind of proposed that they, at this school, that they set up a fireworks lab. And from there, he kind of built the company up. He found it more and more interesting. He found his passion. And then, you know, these days they're doing the opening ceremony to the Olympics. So it's a massive growth for them. But on the other side, there are also these kind of tight and massive companies like, for example, G4S, who are doing the security. And I got an interesting quote from their kind of managing director, who said, "The 2012 Games is a relatively small part of our global work." And that's amazing. That's an amazing quote, considering they just won a $200 million contract. I mean, they have kind of employees all around the world, but I mean, compared to Kim Bolton, it's you know, small beer for them.
You're talking about the, you know, the British companies that won the contracts, but obviously you said that some of the other jobs had to be done by non-British companies. Who won what in those departments?
There were some really interesting ones. For example, there's a company called Doublet. I think I'm pronouncing that right. Doublet. And they're a French company, and they specialise in making flags. And they'll actually be making a lot of the Union Jacks for the Olympic ceremony. So, for example, the flag that's lowered down in the victory ceremony, that they'll be made by a French company, the Union Jack. And, I mean, a lot of the English media made a very big deal out of that. I mean, somewhat unfairly, I thought. There was a very interesting article in the Daily Mail that said, you know, these French, they know so little about the Union Jack that on their website, this company, Doublet, on their website, they've displayed it the wrong way down. They've hung it kind of vertically. But I thought that was a bit unfair, because obviously when you see the victory ceremonies, they're all hung vertically. They're not kind of waving horizontally. So I thought that was a bit much.
The flag is obviously one of the surprises in terms of who won what contract. Were there any other surprises that you noticed?
The other one that surprised me and that has surprised quite a few people is the ticketing company. The tickets are all being made in Arkansas in the US, and they're actually, you know, most of them are going to be freighted to the people who've been lucky enough to get tickets at a cost of about £6 each. So this company, they've kind of, they started out about 100 years ago making circus tickets and stuff like that, and they've grown to supply the Olympics, but they're all coming from Arkansas, which I also found was surprising.
And were there any companies, I'm thinking of one in particular, which started off as an associate, but recent events have sort of made it not so appealing a company to have on the scene? I'm thinking more media coverage.
Of course. I mean, News International were a big part of the kind of media coverage of the Olympics, and they were actually slated as an official media partner for the Great British team, but they were dropped because of the kind of scandal that surrounded News of the World and the phone hacking scandal. And the Press Association have stepped up to kind of be the official kind of media organisation covering the Great British team, and that, which is interesting as well, because they've been there. They were there in 1908, the last time actually the first time that London had the Olympics, so they'll come back again for 2012.
And was there any one thing or company who really impressed you or conversely really disappointed you?
Probably just for weirdness, just a bit of a weird factor. I found Mondo, which is an Italian company. They are providing the tracks, and they're quite a famous company. They've provided, you know, I think 10 straight Olympics. They've been the official providers of the running tracks, and even Usain Bolt thanked them after he kind of broke that famous 100-meter record. A weird thing about their company is, aside from, you know, leading this field, they also just on the side, on the sly, also manufacture luxury yachts, which is just fun. Sure, why not? You know, I assume, you know, maybe it's made out of the same material. Who knows?
Adrian, thank you very much indeed. That was Monocle 24's Adrian Craddock describing to me the weird factor of the Olympic suppliers. It's 20 minutes to the top of the hour. We'll be right back in a moment where we'll be talking about the demise of yet another Scandi airline.
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Essa Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
And a Monocle 24 Tag, ja.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The proper Jalavet. Monocle 24.
Esto es Monocle 24.
After I'm into Monocle 24.
The hat at Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
24. 24. 24.
Welcome back to Midori House. There's yet more turbulence in the skies above Scandinavia. It's barely 3 weeks since SAS posted terrible figures and Kimber Air filed for bankruptcy. Now, Kimber's sister carrier Skyways and its subsidiary City Airlines have also gone the same way, with all flights cancelled and up to 12,000 passengers believed to have been affected. Well, high fuel prices and sluggish growth are once again being blamed for the demise of yet another airline. To discuss this, we're joined by our editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé, who's come down to sit in the studio with us. A very warm welcome back to Midori House.
Thank you very much.
And also Murdo Morrison, editor of Flight International magazine. Murdo, you're on Monocle 24 twice in 24 hours. You gazed into your crystal ball and predicted something a little bit like this earlier on, didn't you?
Well, I'm not sure if I predicted this, but I think this is part of airlines come and go all the time. And if you look back on the last 10 years, there's been a history of airline failures and other airlines coming on the scene. But I think what we are perhaps seeing in the last few months is a concentration of airline failures that does perhaps suggest that, you know, we're seeing a consolidation in the European industry. You know, we've seen the failure of Malév in Hungary, of Spanair, quite a few other airlines in pretty serious trouble. And I think this could be possibly just the start of something a bit more serious.
Is this perhaps the natural rebalancing of an overly full Scandinavian market?
Yeah, I think if you look at the Scandinavian market, that's very much the case. I mean, not all airlines in Scandinavia are struggling. We've seen the failure of Kimber, of course, in Denmark, and SAS and Finnair with their problems. But of course, Norwegian, the airline from that country, set up really in competition as a low cost competitor to SAS, is doing very, very well and ordering a whole lot of airlines and launching new routes.
Murdo, I wanted to ask you, and we didn't pick up on it during the briefing today, but there's sort of a cyclical element in another way too, that if you look at SAS, they've got, you know, a fleet of real fuel guzzlers. They're still flying around old MD-80, they're almost vintage aircraft at this point. And you could also argue, you know, the same too with Skyways, with old, you know, old Fokkers as well. So, you know, in many ways, we think about the Nordic, you know, region as, you know, being, you know, ultra-modern, early adopters, but is part of it, you know, this shakeout has to do with, you know, with the fact that, you know, some of these carriers may be a decent brand, good routes, but, you know, simply old stock. And as you pointed out today, when the fuel price goes in the wrong direction, if you've got these type of aircraft, you know, you're going to be looking at a very tricky balance sheet.
Yeah, I think that's very much the case, and especially with regional jets, which they were operating, the BAE 146 and Embraer ERJ 135s. Small jets are not very economical when the fuel price is high. You can just about get off with it with turboprops, but with jets, with the sort of revenues that you're making, and with older jets in particular, which are that bit less fuel efficient. Yes, certainly the profile of an airline's fleet certainly has a lot to do with its costs. And yes, as you say, with SAS, one of the problems is that their fuel bill is even higher than it perhaps should be because they're operating very, very inefficient aircraft.
I want to just, you referenced Malev earlier on, and I wonder if you could maybe tell us, you know, what happens when, well, in this case, you know, a flag carrier, a legacy carrier in that case, you know, when they go bust, does the market immediately fill up right away that you see most of the routes, you know, snatched up either by low-cost carriers or, you know, I did notice, you know, for example, in the case of Budapest, that we saw a lot more frequency suddenly with Lufthansa, you know, trying to you know, connect people through their main hubs. Does the same thing, you know, happen then in the Nordic region, that just other carriers will step into the breach?
I think it will do. I mean, it's in a deregulated market. It's supply and demand. And if there's passengers in a city at an airport willing to fly, then generally airlines will come in and fill that and meet that demand. We saw it in Hungary when Malev went, as you said, Lufthansa. Ryanair as well opened a whole pile of routes into Budapest. You know, we saw it with Sabena in Belgium, with in Brazil. You know, usually there's a lot of doom and gloom when a flag carrier goes bust, and or when any airline goes bust, and the unions will say that it's a disaster for the country, and politicians will say that. But generally, what happens is that if there's passenger demand there, then airlines will come in and meet that demand, and probably do it a lot more efficiently, cheaper, and in a more customer-friendly way than perhaps the incumbent was doing.
We were talking about how times are so tough for SAS. This is more bad news for them, isn't it? Because they had code share agreements with Skyways and City Airlines, didn't they?
Yeah, I mean, it's another blow for SAS. They've had quite a few recently. I mean, code shares aren't, you know, the end of an airline that's doing code shares isn't the demise of that airline isn't the end of the world for SAS. So it won't be their biggest problem at the moment, because they can usually find another partner. But yes, it will have an impact on their operations. Yeah.
Sorry,
I was just going to say, Emma, that I think also one of the challenges, you know, here as well, when you look at, you know, vast regions, and, you know, particularly when you look at Sweden, you know, just the length of the country, remote communities, you know, oftentimes, as you said, you know, if there's passengers that, you know, therefore, you know, someone, you know, will step in, and the market, you know, forces will hopefully solve things. But I imagine, though, as well, though, there must be quite a few government subsidies probably kicking around. I mean, I've certainly heard in the case of remote communities in Norway, way that, you know, in fact, some airlines like to win those contracts because planes, empty or full, they're getting a check every time they land. And I wonder if there's a component of that in this as well. You know, whoever sort of, you know, picks up the scraps. I'm not sure if this is the case with all of Skyway's routes, but I imagine some of them, they, you know, they are smaller communities, and you can you know, certainly fly in, you know, a small Embraer or something. But, you know, nevertheless, they're still remote. There aren't alternatives, either buses or trains. So do you think there's a side as well that people are maybe thinking, great, there's some wonderful Swedish contracts to be picked up here from the government?
Yeah, I think right throughout the Scandinavian region, I mean, governments here, you say, huge countries and very, very remote communities, and air travel is essential to the whole social cohesion. I grew up in the north of Scotland. It's exactly the same. You have to have air services for you know, for society to function, really, for business connections to function, and generally governments will be prepared to subsidise these. I'm not an expert on whether Skyways had a lot of these contracts. I don't think it did, but obviously now with pressure, fiscal pressures on all governments, I guess that's another area that will be under a little bit of pressure.
We were mentioning a moment ago Embraer aircraft. Is there a possibility that someone like Flybe Nordic could jump in?
Yes, I think there is. That's certainly one possibility. I think that, as I said earlier, if there are routes where passengers are prepared to travel, or indeed social routes that the government is prepared to subsidise, then I don't think there will be a problem with people being unable to fly or being cut off. I mean, it does happen, but generally supply will meet demand.
Just before we go, Murdo, we've heard that Scandinavian is looking at a rebrand. Certainly, if I was a CEO at the moment, you know, I think that there's probably better things that they could be spending their money on, a coat of paint, and I mean, yes, they should spend their money on maybe some new aircraft, but certainly not a whole new identity, because I doubt that that's going to save anything. But looking into your crystal ball a little bit, as you mentioned, we've seen problems at Finnair earlier today. We were talking about the whole issue of, you know, Finnair has built up this great long haul network, but, you know, now they're talking about, you know, how do they spin off the short haul carrier? You think, well, if I'm an Asian passenger, I land in Helsinki, I get on this, this short haul aircraft, which has nothing to do with my long haul experience. So you've got them, you've got, you know, a troubled Scandinavia, and then you've got the power of Norwegian. Is that pretty much how the market's going to look now? Norwegian dominance on the low cost, but also innovation sector. They've got a lot of broadband enabled aircraft. Maybe Finnair making a go of it long haul, and Scandinavian probably just trying to keep main trunk routes.
Yeah, I think that's. I think it's not beyond belief that we'll see a whole restructuring of the European airline industry. And, you know, it's a myth sometimes to think of low cost, you know, back in the 90s, I guess, when you flew on EasyJet and it was pretty cheap and nasty, and sort of cabin crew and sweatshirts and chucking you a few sandwiches and that. But the low cost airlines, even Ryanair, have really sort of upped their service in many ways. Their brand is a lot more polished. And if you look around the world, there are examples of low cost airlines that are, you know, offering in-flight entertainment and, you know, perhaps not the traditional frills of a legacy carrier's low-cost short-haul operation, but they're certainly doing innovative things. The problem that the flag carriers, the big legacy airlines, have got to get their heads around, and it's very, very difficult, is how they make this connect between high-cost and usually loss-making short-haul operations and potentially profitable long-haul operations.
Murdo Morrison, editor of Flight International magazine, and our editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé. Thank you very much for joining us. The time is 9 minutes to the top of the hour. You're listening to Midori House.
From São Paulo to Sapporo, from Brooklyn to Buenos Aires, with a samba, bossa, jazz, poppier, rock and roller, frankly far superior station, to discover the newest and finest sounds. This is the sound of Monocle spinning its musical globe. Check in with our editors turned DJs as they whisk you through the time zones as we take you continental, Atlantic and Pacific. Round the clock, round the block, music on Monocle 24.
Nestled into the urban fabric of London, Hong Kong, New York and Tokyo, Monocle shops are small, cosy outposts of everything we care about. That's incredible design, credible provenance, charming service, and of course, intelligent journalism. Stock up on the latest issue of the magazine, browse our carefully curated selection of books and music, or seek out your favourite back issue to fill that gap in your Monocle archive. So, drop in to one of our shops, and our friendly staff will be on hand to show you around. For addresses and opening hours, visit monocle.com.
Welcome back to Midori House. The time is 7 minutes towards the top of the hour. Time for some music. This is Frou Frou and Let Go. That was Let Go by Frou Frou. You're listening to Midori House. Well, the ascent of a mountain is generally considered to be a solitary affair when a man or woman pits him or herself against nature's toughest obstacle. But more than 200 people will try to reach the summit of Mount Everest this weekend alone. Four people have lost their lives in the attempts in the last few days. Overcrowding is being blamed as one of the factors. Joining us now is Alan Nichols, the president of the Explorers Club. Alan, very warm welcome to Midori House. What are these people dying from? Is it overcrowding has got something to do with it?
Oh, of course, and also, you know, not being trained sufficiently because there's kind of the reputation that if you have enough money, anywhere from $50,000 to $75,000 with a lot of expeditions, they'll get you up there.
So how did we get to the stage where 200 people will make an attempt this weekend?
Oh, well, first place, it's, you know, the time is a good time to do it, so that attracts a lot of people. And secondly, you know, Everest has become like a sacred mountain. It's like pilgrims. You, in our culture, to, you know, attain the highest mountain in the world is like a major spiritual advancement, so it just attracts more and more people. I mean, this is a little extreme in terms of numbers, but that is, and of course, going, the more people you have, the more chance. You know, it's a dangerous mountain. The weather changes and things like that, so that you're going to have a percentage of people that are going to die.
You mentioned it being a sacred mountain, a place of spirituality, but surely the great groups that are going up have very little interest in the spiritual side and are just taking a commercial view of things.
Well, not spiritual in the historic sense. You know, it's to the Tibetans, the goddess of the mountain it's a sacred mountain, but certainly not the most important one like Mount Kailas. But remember, we have our own sacredness, that is, we moderns, and to attain the highest point is more important that's what we really care about. That is what our culture cares about, to be on top. In ancient times, they didn't even bother climbing mountains. They circumambulate them like they do in historic mountains. So it is sacred today. What makes things sacred is that everybody thinks about it. In our case, the media talk about it. We have our guides and our Sherpas and our saints. You know, one of our members, of course, Hillary, is a former chair of this organization, so he's the first one up to, he's a modern-day saint. I mean, he compares to the way everybody thought about him and honored him and so forth.
So very briefly, because I'm afraid time is running out on us, how do we balance this risk with this desire to go up Everest?
It always, as always, we learn from exploration more about ourselves. Why are you going up there? Whatever you're trying to discover has a lot to do with yourself. So make it a more traditional spiritual experience, and you won't bother with Everest. You'll go up Ben Nevis up there in north of your country.
Alan,
and you'll get more of an experience than you would on Everest.
Thank you very much indeed, Alan. I'm afraid we have to leave it there. That was Alan Nichols, the president of the Explorers Club. That's all we have time for today. Our producer was Daniel Giacopelli. The researcher was Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond. From me, Emma Nelson, goodbye. Thanks for listening.